This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Cats, as you know, spooky season is upon us, but for some of us, our fears don't fade away after Halloween is over. And therapy is a great way to face your personal fears in order to overcome them. For me personally, therapy is also a tool to manage stress and work on being the best version of myself.
Whether you are looking for a new therapist or trying therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is, well, here to help. Their online appointments are designed to be convenient for your schedule, and all you need to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And you can switch therapists at any time.
BetterHelp makes it so easy to make your mental well-being part of your regular self-care regimen. So why not try BetterHelp?
Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dress today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/dressed.
Save big money in your door project right now at Menards. Update your home with beautiful Mastercraft doors. Mastercraft has been building high-quality doors for over 50 years. Design your door your way with our free step-by-step design program. Or choose from our great in-stock selection. Save big on your new door at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, welcome back to part two of our fascinating conversation with cultural historian Dr. Amanda Wunder, who is joining us again today in a discussion about her wonderful book, Spanish Fashion in the Age of Velázquez, A Tailor at the Court of Philip IV. So if you joined us earlier this week, she introduced us to the incredibly significant role that fashion played at the 17th century court of King Philip IV of Spain, as specifically reflected in the work of Mateo Aguado, who in his role as royal tailor to the queens of Spain, not one but two, served the monarchy for a remarkable 42 years and really did up until the very day he died.
Today, we continue to track the evolution of Mateo's career and work further into the 17th century when he transitioned to dressing Philip IV's second wife, Mariana of Austria, after the untimely death of his first wife, Isabel of Bourbon. And as we will learn today, Mariana brings more than just a new face to the Spanish court. The young queen is also the inspiration behind the most creative decade of Mateo's career. So Amanda, we are so excited to welcome you back to continue this conversation. Thank you for joining us again.
Amanda, welcome back to Dress. I'm so excited to continue our conversation today.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
So Mateo Aguado was a tailor to not one, but two queens of Spain. So in 1649, 2 years after his beloved Queen Isabel of Bourbon's death, she unfortunately died in 1644, King Philip IV married his 14-year-old niece, Mariana of Austria. And actually, can maybe just address the fact that both Isabel and Mariana were so young when they wed Philip IV. Can you tell us about what that was about and why would you marry your niece at this time? Just a little context for our listeners who might have some questions.
So this is part of the diplomacy of marriage and amongst the royal families. And there was a great deal of intermarriage, as your listeners might already know, among the royal family of the Habsburgs. So when Isabel of Bourbon died, as you said, unexpectedly in 1644 at a fairly young age in her early 40s, Philip IV originally wasn't planning to remarry, but then son and heir Baltasar Carlos died in 1646, and the need to have a male heir became urgent enough that Philip IV did, in fact, remarry. And this, of course, creates an opportunity to forge a new alliance of some sort or to reinforce an existing alliance. And so what was decided was that what was best for the Spanish monarchy at the time was to marry Mariana of Austria, who is the niece of Philip IV. She's the daughter of his, or who had gone to be the empress, the Holy Roman Empress. Mariana was quite young. She was 14 when they were engaged and 15 when she actually arrived in Spain. And there was concern at the Spanish court that she wouldn't be able to, again, fill that number one function of a queen, which was to produce the royal children. And it's interesting, there were portraits that were sent from Austria to Madrid to try to shore up her image and show how she'll be able to do this job. She's not too young, not too petite to bear children, to pick up the line. But also I want to say that this phenomenon of really young marriages, which does come as being shocking to us, I was really surprised to find that Mateo Aguado's wife was really young when they married. I have to check the number, but I think she was just 13 years old when they married. And then Aguado married off his daughter at the age of only 11. And I suspect that that was done also on a very lower level for reasons of trying to sort of forge alliances. I think Aguado married off his very young daughter to a bureaucrat in King Philip IV's household, I think trying to build up his family's position at the court. So this kind of marriage was being done at the highest levels and also amongst the middle class, like Aguado.
And I'm not trying to start today's episode on kind of a little bit of a low note, but I just think it's something that I always think about when I read about these young women, especially in the context of what we're about to talk about, is that she's just like 14 years old and she's traveling from her home, the only home she's ever known, to an entire new country away from everyone she knows and loves. They just must have been incredibly scared. And to be so young to have faced that sort of thing, I mean, I guess they probably grew up very quickly. But I want to talk about her arrival in Spain, because the wedding, of course, was the cause of much fanfare and celebration, and something that simultaneously launched Mateo's next act in the most creative decade of his career. I'd love if you could talk about Mateo's work with Mariana of Austria, the new queen, starting with his role in transforming her into a queen of Spain when she first set foot on Spanish soil in the summer of 1649. This is a really fascinating story.
Mateo Aguado's career really tanked with the death of Queen Isabella Bourbon. She was his primary patron, and he kept his job, but there just wasn't that much work to do, and so his income plummeted. And so he had a really bad spell in the later 1640s. But then, as you say, with this new marriage between Philip IV and Mariana of Austria, Aguado suddenly has a new queen to dress, and everything changes for him. She arrives after, as you mentioned, this really long, arduous journey from Vienna to Spain. She lands at the port town of Denia, which is on the Mediterranean coast of Spain. And Aguado was one of the people who traveled from Madrid to meet her there. And so he travels with two of his journeymen, carrying garment bags, holding new dresses that they had made for the queen sight unseen. And earlier that summer, the royal farthingale maker, Diego Lopez, had made farthingales in the Spanish style, which were sent to the Viennese court for Mariana of Austria. And I suspect that this was done so she could practice, so that when she arrived in Spain, she wouldn't make a fool of herself walking around wearing this really cumbersome Spanish style of undergarment. And so Aguado is there to meet her. And I think this is such an interesting thing to imagine, that for both of them, this is such a critical moment. For Mariana of Austria, she's making her first impression on her new subjects. She's meeting her husband for the first time. She's being introduced to Madrid and to the public and to the court where she's going to spend the rest of her life. And for Mateo Aguado, he's meeting his new boss. And so they both need to make a really good impression. And what happens is there's a very long, slow journey from this port town on the Mediterranean to Madrid, where Mariana is going to make her celebratory entry into the city for the first time. And Aguado's traveling with them, making dresses on the road for her to wear at all of her public appearances. So you can just imagine the circumstances that he's working under. He's got his two journeymen with him. And she had, interestingly, snapped up some really fabulous fabrics while she was traveling through northern Italy on her way to Spain. And so some of the things they made were made using these really rich Italian fabrics. And so the two of them, you can just imagine that they meet for the first time. They're establishing their working relationship during a moment of such importance when she is really just being introduced to her new country.
Yeah, and I always have that Marie Antoinette scene in my head, which is when she arrives at the French border, again, also from Austria, and leaves her Austrian identity behind, that kind of symbolic act is directly related to her clothing, right? She literally is stripped at the border. Did something similar happen to Mariana? Did she literally have to take off her Austrian identity and put on the Spanish one?
The Spanish and the Austrian identities are fairly intertwined at this point. And of course, Mariana's mother was Philip IV's sister. And so her mother was Spanish. And so she spoke Spanish already. And Mateo Aguado had actually made some dresses to send to Mariana's mother at the court over the years that she was there. And so Mariana wasn't unfamiliar with Spanish fashion, and she wasn't even unfamiliar with Mateo Aguado's work, which is amazing. So this wasn't all new to her. And I don't have any specific information about her, that dramatic scene in the Sofia Coppola movie of Kirsten Dunst having to lose her Austrian dress. I don't have anything like that for Mariana. But she certainly did arrive in Spain dressed in Spanish. And that was really, really important.
So fascinating. And one of the underlying themes of your book is the evolution of women's fashion at the Spanish court. And that's something that is clearly exhibited when you say, look at portraits of Isabel of Bourbon and then look at portraits of Mariana. So how did fashion change from one queen to the next? And what role did Mateo play in that transformation and innovation?
What we really see in the famous portraits of these queens is most notably a change in the silhouette, right? So we see the evolution from that cone-shaped skirt from the earlier 1600s to this absolutely gigantic guardinfante, which is the farthingale that creates that bell shape that we see in the really iconic imagery of Mariana of Austria from the mid-1650s. And that's most emblematic in the famous Velázquez portrait of Mariana in a black dress with silver decoration, which is on the cover of my book. Now, what we don't see in the portraits is there is also a really clear change in color and decoration of the dresses. Now, what we're seeing in these portraits are state portraits. And so the queens are dressed in black with precious metals. And these are somber, sober, they're working portraits of the queen. But from looking at the documentation, what we learn is that Isabel of Bourbon did, in fact, dress in very sober colors. Her wardrobe was almost entirely, as a queen, her wardrobe was black, brown, dark gray, decorated with gold. This was her taste. This was her style. Mariana of Austria, on the other hand, who was this teenager who arrives in Spain as the queen, had a really different style. And her dresses were made from this incredible range of silks of all different colors. And the names of the colors are beautiful. The colors of sand, the color of grass, the color of the sky. So she has all, it's just a complete range of colors. And the decorations were silver, not gold. There's nothing heavy about this anymore. And also the types of ornaments that Aguado designs for the dresses are totally different. For Isabel of Bourbon, he'd designed this really militaristic decorations of those alamares that we talked about in the earlier episode, which are these soldier-inspired lace buttons, decorative lace buttons. And for Mariana of Austria, he totally gets rid of those. Those really disappear. And instead it's bows and lots of ribbons, very feminine, kind of frilly decorations. And that's, of course, not something that we're seeing in the portraits, but it's something that we can find in the documents.
Yeah, and you write about how he used twice as many colors for Mariana. Quote, these fabrics included shot silks woven with more than one color to create complex shades like colombino, which was pink and white like a radish flower, and aire, a pale apricot color that resembled the sky at dawn. You continue, almost 40% of Mariana's dresses in the 1650s were made from silks interwoven with silver that likely resembled a piece of light green silk shot with silver threads that survived in the form of a chalice veil. And you do include a picture of that in the picture so that we can continue to imagine what this life would have looked like in full color.
That was something that was really important to me with the illustrations of the books, was since none of Aguado's work survives, I really wanted to try to give the reader a sense of what these garments would have looked like. And as much as I could, I found images of surviving garments and textiles and other kinds of items to use to give a sense of the colors and the textures and the decorations that Aguado would have been using.
Yeah, it's just absolutely incredible, as I've emphasized many times already. This book is just so wonderful in that you write about it, but you also show us when you can and support it with really, really incredible images. Mariana's first year was jam-packed with events, and you write about how in 1650, Aguado made dresses for her to wear to 16 special occasions, something you have actually broken down for us in a chart by month that details not only the occasion, but also the dress fabric, decoration, and cost of materials. That's something we haven't really talked about a lot, and that you provide, when you can, all of the different costs and how much things collectively cost, from embroidery to what Aguado was charging, to what the silk merchants were charging, which is just a level of detail that I personally appreciate. And it really, again, just speaks to that richness of your archive and how it informs your storytelling, which is just incredible.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you like the tables. I was really unsure of. I thought those might be just way too nerdy to include in the book. But again, the detail in them, I thought there would be some readers like you who would really want that level of detail. I'm glad that worked for you.
Yes, absolutely appreciated. Thank you so much. So something we talked about in the first part of this episode, but I want to continue here, is just a conversation about what is underneath the queen's wardrobe. Because you write, quote, "Queens were not just made from velvet and damask. They were also constructed out of wire and whalebone and pasteboard and gummed canvas." Maybe a little less glamorous. Can we talk about, we talked about this in the context of Queen Isabel of Bourbon, but can we talk about Queen Mariana's undergarments and the role they and their makers played in changing the shape of fashion across the 17th century?
Sure. So this is where the silk merchant records were so valuable. And this is where I have to thank the COVID pandemic for giving me the time to actually comb through these. I had these PDFs of these silk merchant records, which were so tedious and so awful that I had probably never would have looked at them if it hadn't been for that lockdown. And what I found in there was just incredible riches, which is that Aguado's documents of his accounts of what he made tell us about the fashion fabrics, what the dress was made from on the outside. The silk merchants tell us what was on the inside of the dresses. And so we can actually reconstruct how they were made, how they were reinforced, how these stiff shapes were created with all these layers of really unglamorous fabrics like buckram and gummed canvas. And so we learned that the dresses themselves had this whole infrastructure that was supporting them. But then you still needed all this other apparatus underneath to give them that shape, like that iconic shape that we see in portraits of Queen Mariana of Austria. And so the primary support structure is, of course, going to be the farthingale. And one of the really interesting things that I learned from diving into the documents is that there isn't just one kind of farthingale being worn. There's a whole range of them. And in fact, they could be put into various combinations. And there were short farthingales, there were long ones. You could wear them with extra hip padding or not. And one thing that I speculate from a really interesting portrait of Mariana of Austria in a hunting dress is that I think that what this portrait shows us is that you could actually wear different kinds of farthingales under the same dress to create different shapes. And so in the case of this particular portrait that I'm talking about, the skirts attached to the bodice are crossed over one another over the front. And what I think this means is if you wore it with a larger farthingale, those different pieces of the skirts would be separated and would lie flat. And so I think you could wear a dress with a smaller or a larger farthingale to different effect. And so I think that there is a lot to be learned about what's going on under the skirts and that the queen would have worn different kinds of farthingales for different activities.
Yeah, and that is so fascinating. And so you talked about Mariana in Black and Silver, which is the first portrait that Diego Velázquez made of the queen. It's from 1650. And I just want to read an excerpt from the book because it's just so fascinating. You write that beneath the silk fabrics and silver trimmings on the surface of Mariana's dresses, less glamorous materials give the garments their structure and character. A typical dress used 8 different kinds of fabric in its construction. Unseen inner facings and inner linings made from linen, wool, and flax reinforced stress points in the garments and gave the exterior smooth appearance. And then you write, in 1650, Aguado made Mariana a dress using 16.4 meters of silver and black velvet from Holland that hid over 8 meters combined of buckram canvas, Fustian Enbaes, or Baez. Sorry, dress listeners, if I mispronounced that. And you continue, most of the queen's dresses were lined with taffeta. And so all of this stiff scaffolding is required to achieve this outward silhouette that you see in this portrait. So I don't know why I always find undergarments so fascinating, but they really, really are.
Well, and I think that you could just imagine how much this affects your life and your body, your posture. And the one interesting detail is that Queen Mariana in a letter said that, well, whenever she had the opportunity, she didn't wear a farthingale at all. And so what that tells us is that there were moments certainly when they weren't dressed like this. And one of the things I was most pleased to learn from the documents was that the queens did not wear farthingales at all when they were pregnant, because that was considered to be dangerous to the fetus. And so that was surprisingly humane that they weren't actually wearing the farthingales when they were pregnant. But also, I love this because it finally proves without a doubt against this longstanding rumor that farthingales were designed to hide illicit pregnancies, which of course anatomically makes absolutely no sense.
Exactly.
Because you don't carry a baby in your hips. But this is a persistent rumor that keeps being repeated in the scholarly literature even today. And so now we actually have proof that queens did not wear farthingales when they were pregnant.
Which the next question listeners are going to have is, did they wear corsets?
That I'm not sure, but I don't have any concrete information from Spain. There are some surviving maternity corsets from England, and I wouldn't be surprised if you had something like that in Spain, like perhaps a shorter corset.
Yeah. And absolutely, right? I mean, when you consider this is their only form of bust support, really, this is what women were wearing to support their busts. And again, one of those longstanding fashion history myths is that corsets were torturous, but they were actually in reality a functioning aspect and very necessary aspect of women's fashion at this time that had dual functions, right, of supporting the fashionable silhouette, but also supporting the women's bosom.
Right. You don't want to give up your bra when you're pregnant.
No, exactly. So we cannot talk about Mateo Aguado's life, work, and legacy without addressing his most famous work, which remains celebrated to this very day, even if he himself has fallen into obscurity. And of course, I'm talking about Velázquez's 1656 painting, Las Meninas, which is considered one of the most important paintings in the canon of Western art, depicting Velázquez himself, as well as various people in the entourage of the five-year-old Infanta Margarita, who is the younger daughter of King Philip IV and Queen Mariana. And she is, of course, the painting's central figure, and she would have been dressed by Aguado. So can you please tell us about this portrait through the lens of dress?
Absolutely. Well, so first of all, I don't think you can look at Las Meninas without looking at it through the lens of dress. As you said, that image of the little Infanta Margarita in her enormous skirts is at the absolute focal point of the composition. The dress just draws your eyes right to it. And what I can tell you from all this work on the tailor who dressed Margarita is that it really confirms some really interesting things about the purpose of the painting. There's a Spanish art historian named Mercedes Llorente who some years ago theorized that Las Meninas was showing Margarita coming of age. And she based this on research into the literature of childhood and transitions to adulthood, and speculated that the portrait was really showcasing the Infanta Margarita going from being a girl to basically growing up and leaving infancy behind. And through the documentation, I'm able to absolutely prove this theory correct, because what I found was that it was precisely in the months leading up to the painting of Las Meninas that Aguado began to dress the Infanta Margarita in adult women's clothing. It was between January and April of 1656 that he stopped making her the clothing of a toddler and started dressing her in the clothing of an adult woman, which meant that she was then wearing the farthingale under her skirts. So absolutely, Las Meninas commemorates this moment of transition in the Infanta life. Also, I think fascinatingly, there is an account of a dress that was sent for Margarita from the court at Naples, which was a viceroyalty of the Spanish kingdom. And this was a dress described as being embroidered with little silver points. And of course, the decoration on the dress in Las Meninas looks like little silver points. And this was the first dress that's entered in Aguado's accounts as having been made for Margarita in the adult style. So not only does Las Meninas commemorate Margarita's transition to adult dress, but it seems like it also very likely commemorates this really expensive gift from Naples. So it's doing two things at once.
And I think these portraits are also really helpful too, and you talk about this in the book, is they're helpful in seeing how fashions were accessorized as well, right? Which is something you don't necessarily get by reading texts, but you can actually see it depicted in this portrait. And that goes for this portrait as well, which is just so fascinating because she's such a little girl. She's only 5 years old.
And this to this idea of what the portraits contribute to the documents, it's just enormous. I mean, if you just read Mateo Aguado's documents, you would never know that this radical change in silhouette had ever taken place because he's using the same terms to describe the garments that he's making. So you would think, oh, there's just continuity over the course of all these decades. But of course, we know from the portraits that there's a great deal of change in the shape of the garments.
And Mateo was responsible for not just dressing Margarita, but also her half-sister, Maria Teresa. And you write about how from essentially the day they were born until they, quote, left Madrid to marry abroad, Mateo was responsible for designing the dresses that they wore at each phase of the matchmaking process. And this is incredibly significant, especially because Maria Teresa will become the Queen of France, wife of Louis XIV, and Margarita, the Holy Roman Empress, wife of Leopold I. And I mean, this really just speaks to the incredible political and diplomatic significance of Mateo's work. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So these marriages of the Spanish infantas abroad were this really important opportunity for the Spanish crown to forge alliances and even end wars in the case of the marriage of Maria Teresa to Louis XIV of France. And so the diplomatic negotiations that are involved in these marriages went on for an incredibly long time, and there were really, really high stakes. And we read about these negotiations in the history books, and it's all about these really important prime ministers and kings and these figures. But behind the scenes, you've got someone like Mateo Aguado, who's also playing a previously really undiscovered role in the process. And I say this because the Infanta's appearances were scrutinized mercilessly by the other European courts in the process of these marriage negotiations. Of course, the other courts are really keen to know, are these girls going to be able to produce heirs to our throne? Are they healthy? Are they sound? They're going to be our future queens. And so their representatives are coming to the Spanish court and looking at the infantas and judging them and their appearances. They're having to appear in public, but they don't have a speaking role in any of these processes. And they don't have a voice in their futures. But this is a case where their dresses are really speaking for them. And of course, the person who's making the dresses is Mateo Aguado. And there is some really, really clear evidence about the dresses being used as a sort of sartorial code to communicate with other courts. In one particular case, when the Spanish started getting really serious about marrying Maria Teresa to Louis XIV of France, and to signal this, at the baptism of Maria Teresa's younger brother, she wore a dress that Aguado had made from an unusual fabric, which was a red and white striped silk. And there is a printed pamphlet that explains that this signified the union of the white fleur-de-lis of France and the red rose of Castile. And so the dress was speaking in code, and then this printed account, which was, of course, printed with the will of the court, was explaining its meaning and disseminating knowledge about this symbolic dress. So the dresses that Aguado is making are, in fact, playing a part in these negotiations from start to finish.
Yes, an incredibly central and important role, which, you know, again, because his name had been lost for so long, that kind of contribution and the fact that someone is behind the seams literally making these clothes and playing such a central part in the construction of these women's images, I mean, that is one of the interventions of this book, right? And why we're so incredibly grateful for you for bringing it to light. Dress listeners, we know from experience that getting started investing can feel confusing. Especially with so many options out there, many people tend to put it off. But it does not need to be intimidating.
Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. And you don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you.
Acorns offers a learning platform for anyone wanting to learn more about investing strategies and also offers ESG portfolios, which invest your money in companies rated for their impact on environment, social, and governance issues, something that you know we love on Dressed.
So what are you waiting for? Head to acorns.com/dressed or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing in your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/dressed. Ladies, are you finding yourself a bit off or experiencing cravings or bloating? Well, these are potential symptoms of PMS or menopause, and Hormone Harmony is here to help.
Hormone Harmony is capsule-based and contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body to adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's truly become a phenomenon. With 17,000 reviews, a bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds.
You too can join the more than 2 million happy Hormone Harmony customers. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Artifact Uprising wants to help you preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want to say I love you with the perfect gift, display favorite memories in your home, or connect with loved ones throughout the year, they have a product you can personalize.
Yes, so many wonderful products, and that even includes baby board books, which is something that I recently personalized for my 2-year-old son, Leo, who loves to read. And I titled the book, A Boy Named Leo. And the best part is that it all comes illustrated with some of my favorite pictures of him by himself and with family and friends. It really is such a sweet, unique, and special commemoration of our life together thus far, and something we will all cherish forever.
Artifact Uprising makes it easy to tell your story. Through the end of the year, Dressed listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use the code DRESSED through December 31st.
Arguably the culmination of Aguado's career are the 22 dresses that he made for Maria Teresa's trousseau, which you reconstruct for us in painstaking detail in the book. Thank you, Charts. Please tell us about this trousseau and its significance to what dress historian Diana DeMarley, who you quote in the book, she calls it the most famous costume clash of the century. This is one of my favorite parts.
Thank you. So this is when Maria Teresa and Philip IV travel from Madrid to the border between Spain and France to meet Louis XIV and his retinue. And the kings are going to sign the peace treaty that's going to settle a war that has been between the two countries for 25 years now, a war that's being ended thanks to this marriage. And Mateo Aguado, in the 6 months leading up to this journey, is frenetically working to make the trousseau of dresses that Maria Teresa is going to take with her on this trip. And so these are the dresses she'll wear on the route, appearing in all these various towns of Spain on the way to the border with France. She'll wear them once they get to the border. There's going to be several different marriage ceremonies. She wears them there. She wears one at the signing of the peace treaty. And then eventually she will be stripped of her Spanish clothes and cross the border and dress in France for the rest of her life as the Queen of France. But so these are her Spanish dresses. And the accounts that we have of this, there are some very famous accounts that are quite well known by the French women who accompany Louis XIV to this event. And they described the Infanta's horrible dresses. They were incredibly catty and had terrible things to say. They made a lot of fun of her dresses, that the Spanish style was absolutely revolting. And that's pretty much what we've known about them up to this point. But what I have to reconstruct what she was actually wearing comes from not only Aguado's documents of what he made, but also this incredible resource, which is the embroiderer's account of his decorations of the dresses. And this is dozens of pages of him describing every detail of the decoration, all the different types of flowers that he was embroidering on them. And so we know now not only what the fabrics the dresses were made from, the different colors, but also lots and lots of details of the often symbolic decorations that were used to adorn them. And what I love about this is it gives us just a totally different view on this trousseau of dresses than what we had from those French sources. The embroiderer was incredibly proud of his work. He talked about how many of the, some of the designs were just exceptionally novel and new. And there's a news account from Madrid describing the Infanta and Philip IV setting off on their journey with this trousseau of dresses, which it described as being of such variety and such splendid craftsmanship. And so these were dresses that were really celebrated in Spain, which just gives us a totally different perspective from what we've ever read before.
Oh, absolutely. And so I want to go to your table three, which I keep talking about the charts, which is embroidered dresses for the Infanta Maria Teresa's journey to France, 1660, in which you outline for us not only the description of the decoration, but the embroiderer's fee. And you write about how the embroiderer, who you name Juan Garcia de la Fuente, left a 40-page account of his work on her trousseau, which is just remarkable. So again, you're able to quite literally reconstruct these garments for us so that maybe they're not all depicted and captured visually for us, but you just do a remarkable job of bringing them to us in the detail that you found in the archive.
Thank you so much.
And also, Aguado, it should be said, did not just make dresses. He made, as you tell us, 24 linen waistcoats with black lace, 16 bone corsets with skirts and sleeves, and 8 sets of matching petticoats in every color, traveling cloaks in various colors, and an embroidered scarlet coat lined in white satin. And as you just spoke to, all of this fanfare to create this incredibly expensive trousseau, after her wedding to Louis XIV, she's dressed exclusively in French clothing.
Exactly. And so the big mystery is what happened to these dresses and all of these other pieces that they made. And I think we can speculate. There's lots of possibilities. I mean, they probably were disseminated amongst the ladies who traveled with her. The richer fabrics could have been reused for ecclesiastical decorations of some sort. We don't know if they were kept in their trunks and went to France and then were destroyed with the burning of Versailles during the French Revolution. Who knows? But again, maybe some bits and pieces will turn up someday.
Yeah, and I do want to just say, too, that it is like night and day when you compare her portraits of being a Spanish princess to being a French queen. You see a huge distinction in the fashion. Something we haven't really talked about is hairstyle. Can you talk about that distinctive wide hairstyle that the Spanish women are wearing? Because that completely goes away when she becomes a queen of France.
Ah, yes. So and this is something that the foreign visitors to the Madrid court were just appalled by Maria Teresa's wigs. They thought her hair was just awful because the French hairstyle at the time was a much more natural look with your real hair. Of course, what we see with Maria Teresa with that sort of rainbow-shaped hairdo is that's a wig, or it's false hair interwoven with her real hair. And I desperately wish I could tell you more about the wig makers at the court, but this is a case where we don't have any surviving documents from them. I think that would be a fascinating thing to learn more about what they were doing and their craft. But we do know from portraits, again, that the hairstyles changed really rapidly, especially in the 1650s. They evolved very much in tandem with the styles of the fashions, particularly with skirt shapes and with collars. And so depending on how high or low cut the dress is, the hairstyle is going to be longer or shorter. And what we're going to see later in the 17th century after Maria Teresa moves to France is that gowns become more low cut and hair becomes longer and things really do evolve.
Yeah, I mean, this hairstyle is very distinctive also, I think, because you can't help but make the comparison between its shape and the bell shape of the Guardia Infante skirt. They're very similar and very distinctive and often decorated and always decorated with all of these different hair accessories. It's a really remarkable feat of hairdressing.
Well, it is. They've got feathers and jewels and some kind of lace netting. They're just really remarkable.
Yeah. And then the distinction is when she becomes that French queen, she's suddenly in this incredibly different silhouette. It's a lot less structured. I mean, still very ornate and decorated, but you don't have that giant bell-shaped underskirt. You have a much more low-cut decorated bodice. And so it's really, really remarkable, that difference in fashion, and something Perhaps I will do a reel about to illustrate, because it does have to be seen to be truly appreciated.
Great to see.
So despite the front-facing successes of Aguado's 3 decades of service to the Spanish royal family, not everything was always silver lame and rainbows. He faced many personal hardships that you remarkably bring to light in the book, and you talked about it a little bit in the part one of this episode. And he experienced these also in the last decade of his life. How did Aguado's end-of-life documents that you examined help to paint a portrait of his personal life beyond his aesthetic contributions, and why was that also important to your story?
Well, this moment when Aguado made Maria Teresa's trousseau was really the high point of his career. So that was, again, in 1660. And then shortly after this, he sits down to write his last will and testament. And then over subsequent years, he revised the document a couple more times. And we have these testaments in addition to his post-mortem inventory, which I mentioned in the previous episode. And so from these documents, what we can reconstruct is what happens after this climactic moment with dressing Maria Teresa for her marriage to Louis XIV. And things really went downhill for Aguado from that point forward. This is when he committed some act of disobedience against his superior and was briefly thrown in jail and lost his job, although he was brought back fairly quickly. He lost his only son, Nicolas Aguado, who had secured a really great position in the court bureaucracy as an accountant, and he died young and left his orphaned son in Aguado's care. Aguado starts to suffer from some unnamed health problems during this time, and so he's really pretty desperately trying to place his 2 living daughters in positions that will give them a guaranteed income after he's gone. And he really spends his final years, it seems, mostly dedicated to trying to get things sorted out for them. After Philip IV dies in 1665, Aguado really loses his work because Queen Mariana of Austria starts to dress in widow's weeds. And so Aguado's no longer making these fabulous confections and inventing new creations as he'd been doing in the previous decades. And then, of course, the Infanta Margarita marries Leopold I and moves to the Viennese court for the Austrian Habsburgs. And so Aguado's career effectively is over, although he's still working for the court at this time. But really, the high point has passed. And so these end-of-life documents that you mentioned are, I think they're so important for getting a sense of Aguado's personal life, his family life. We can learn where he lived and how he lived. And to me, that's one of the most fascinating things I was able to figure out.
Because you're looking at his will, right? Because I think the last chapter of your book, you're literally reconstructing what his world must have been like based on what was represented as far as material culture in his will.
Exactly. And so what we really have here is the material culture of an artisan. And so Aguado, as I was able to find out, lived in, he had a really impressive house on the Calle Mayor. And you can actually go visit the spot where it was today. It's a very distinctive plot of land that has this acute angle on the corner with Calle Bordadores and the Calle Mayor. And so he has this huge house, and it's filled with all the things that an aristocratic resident of Madrid in the late 17th century would have owned. Aguado had all the furnishings you would expect, and the Spanish style at the time was these heavy sort of velvet-covered chairs and draperies. He had a collection of paintings, which included portraits of the royal family. He had a modest library, which is really interesting, I think, for a tailor too. He was a reader, mostly had devotional works and works of contemporary fiction like Cervantes and Quevedo. And so we get a little better sense of Aguado as a person, as a human being, what his interests were and what his family life was like.
And Mateo would continue to serve in his role as the Queen's tailor until his death on November 5th, 1672, after which he was replaced at court, and his legacy slowly faded into obscurity, even as his work was immortalized by one of the most famous painters in history. So what is Mateo Aguado's legacy, and what do you ultimately hope people take away from this book?
Yeah, I think it's hard to put into words Aguado's legacy, because it's nothing short of the image of Spain and Spanishness that continues to this day.
Exactly.
When I was last in Madrid in February, there were posters in the streets for Fashion Week in Madrid. And they had a little icon that was the silhouette of a woman dressed in the court style of the mid-1650s. And of course, it is Aguado who was the designer of that look. And that is still considered to be the look of Spain, the look of Spanishness. And the figure of the Menina from Velázquez's famous painting is like the mascot of Madrid. And so the dresses that Aguado created, while they don't survive, the image of those dresses has absolutely permeated the culture. And you see it everywhere when you go to Madrid today. So what my hope for this book is that we'll start to put the name to the creations and to think about the tailor as a really important figure in the making of Golden Age Spanish culture. And so I hope that people will learn the name of Mateo Aguado, and he'll enter the canon among those really important culture makers of the time period, alongside the names of Velázquez and Quevedo and that crew. And more broadly, I hope that people will be thinking more and more about the people who made clothes and not just the people who wore them.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm really hoping, too, that it will inspire other scholars to maybe pull some of these threads that you only started to pull, right, and continue down those pathways, or just be inspired to look for those makers in the places that we know they must have been, because a Spanish court can't be the only place that's keeping these detailed records about their artisans. So hopefully in the future, we'll see more work that's benefiting from this type of scholarship that you've shown us how to do. And this book is really just a treasure trove of archival sources. As I said, really just skims the surface of so many fascinating topics deserving of more attention. Before I let you go, I just have to know, do you have plans for a follow-up book?
Yes. Well, so right now I'm very excited. I'm working on a small exhibition for the Hispanic Society of America, which is a jewel of a museum and library in northern Manhattan. And it's going to be an exhibition about Spanish fashion in the 16th and 17th centuries. And that's scheduled to open in November of 2025. So I'd love to talk to you again when that happens.
Oh, yes, please do.
And then I'm starting to think about doing a book that's the book that I originally set out to write when I ended up writing this book, which is that broader history of Spanish fashion over the whole period of the Spanish Empire. So 1492 to 1700 or maybe even into a little bit into the 18th century, and looking at the evolution of Spanish fashion and getting beyond the court to look more at the fashion in the lives of everyday people and their experiences with their clothing.
Yeah, which is something we did not, unfortunately, get to talk too much about. But that actually intersects, as you and I were talking about before we recorded, intersects with my own work and my own research on New Mexico history, because, of course, the Spanish Empire was vast at one point and extended to South and North America, and New Mexico is kind of like the northernmost tip of the Spanish Empire. And it's just never ceases to amaze me that how far Spanish fashion traveled from the courts of Spain to this northernmost frontier, but it did. So,
well, and maybe you could be the one to find one of Mateo Aguado's dresses in a trunk in New Mexico somewhere, because I have no doubt that he, you know, he dressed all the ladies in waiting for the Spanish queens, and they're the ones who ended up becoming the wives of the viceroys who traveled to the Americas. And there are some women who he certainly dressed who traveled to the Americas. So maybe those dresses survive somewhere.
Yes. All right. Well, Amanda, thank you so much. This has been so wonderful.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Amanda, thank you so much for this incredibly illuminating journey back to this exciting period of fashion history, and also for introducing us to this, I guess, no longer forgotten fashion luminary, Mateo Aguado. Cass, you and I love to do this so much when we get to reveal other fellow scholars' brand new work that opens up our field of fashion history. This is amazing.
Yes, absolutely. And I cannot stress enough how important Amanda's work is, especially because she's not working, as she talked about, with extant garments of any kind. So she's really piecing this story together using different types of archival sources, with the result that you really get this 360-degree view of not only Mateo's life, but the royal world within which he was operating. And Mateo is just one person, right, April, working behind the scenes of fashion history, but there are so, so many others.
I think that does it for us today, dress listeners. May you consider all of the fashion history makers, out there just waiting to be discovered today, next time you get dressed. You can get your hands on a copy of Amanda's book, Spanish Fashion and the Age of Velázquez, A Tailor at the Court of Philip IV, by heading over to the link on our show notes for our dress bookshelf on bookshop.org. Here you will find Amanda's book and over 150 of our favorite fashion history titles.
And dresshistory.com is where you will find all of Dress's latest offering, including the aforementioned Fashion History Friday nights at the Metropolitan Museum of Art with April, and my current class offerings, which are What Women Wore to the Revolution, 1930s to 1960s, and Worn to Win, Dressing the Summer Olympic Athlete, which is the first class in a series we hope to do more of, the Picturing Dress series, which is going to visually illustrate new and past dress podcast episodes.
Speaking of which, we are rapidly approaching our 500th episode of Dressed, listeners, and we would love to celebrate with you. So, in preparation for this, we're going to take a wee summer hiatus in a few weeks, but when we return in August, we hope that you will join us for a free live recording of our 500th episode on August 11th. Again, this event is going to be free, but space will be limited, so head over to dressedhistory.com to reserve your spot for the festivities.
Yes, yes, yes. We are so excited to celebrate with you. And we love hearing from you, so don't hesitate to reach out to us at hello@dresshistory.com. You can always direct message us on Instagram at @dress_podcast, which is, of course, where you will find images and reels to accompany each week's episode. If you want to find the Instagram content specifically connected to this episode, check out the hashtag #dressed495 and #dressed496. As always, thank you so much for your continued support. More Dress coming your way next week. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
Save big money this October at Menards. October is Fire Safety Month. From smoke and carbon monoxide alarms to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde home safety products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Get a Kidde direct wire smoke alarm. A hardwired smoke alarm also has a AA battery backup for coverage in case of power outages. Save big at Menards and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big.